From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and soundbites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
We congratulate President Trump for the victory, and we are looking forward to work with him, with the administration. We have major tasks ahead of us. The enemies of the United States are the enemy of Israel, and I'm sure we will continue to work together.
That was Israeli Ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon, yesterday at the United Nations. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. In Israel, leaders and citizens alike are celebrating former President Donald Trump's decisive win on Tuesday. Meanwhile, Hamas leadership is calling for an immediate end to the ongoing conflict. Why the sudden change of heart? We'll discuss this with Carolyn Glick from the Jewish News Syndicate in Israel. Yesterday, we covered the recent victories in three states that defeated Planned Parenthood's abortion amendments that were on state ballots. This was thanks in part to key state leadership. Well, today we're going to talk with one of those leaders, Nebraska Attorney General Mike Hilgers, to learn more about their strategy.
When Republicans regain control, which we pray tonight that that's what's going to happen, we're going to have the most aggressive first 100 days agenda that anybody's seen in a modern era. And we got to fix everything, everything.
That was House Speaker Mike Johnson during his victory speech in Shreveport, Louisiana on Tuesday night. It appears that the Republicans will indeed retain control of the House. But what does the upcoming 100-day agenda look like? We'll be joined by House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, another Louisiana congressman reelected Tuesday night, to get his insights. And some of the newly elected congressional members are already here in D.C. We'll hear from one of them, Pastor Mark Harris from North Carolina, who's no stranger to the Washington Watch audience, will join me here in studio. Let me encourage you, if you've not yet downloaded the Stand Firm app, you can get the app at the App Store. It's the Stand Firm app. Or you can text APP to 67742. That's APP to 67742. Starting tomorrow, we're going to have a special initiative with prayer points. It's going to be very critical over the next 2.5 months during this lame duck period to make sure we're praying for our nation and the safety of the world. So get the Stand Firm app and you'll have the prayer points right there in your pocket. Well, Republicans have taken back the White House and the United States Senate. As of about an hour ago, the GOP picked up the Pennsylvania Senate seat, giving them 53 seats in the Senate. There are still over 40 House races yet to be called, but it does appear Republicans will retain control of the House of Representatives. But congressional leaders in the House are not sitting by and waiting. They're already at work on an ambitious plan that will address the concerns of the American people. And that's going to be launched immediately upon the when Donald Trump takes office. Joining me now to discuss this is House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who represents the 1st Congressional District of Louisiana. Leader Scalise, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's great to be back with you. Especially after such an historic victory for President Trump and the country on Tuesday night.
Well, let me start by congratulating you on winning your race. So that's number one. Number two, give us the latest, because I know you were crisscrossing the country, as was Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, campaigning, raising money. Where do we stand right now? What seats are we waiting to see to determine control of the House?
Yeah, you know, where we are right now, there's 213 seats that have been called for the Republicans, 200 for the Democrats. So 218 is the majority. We're five away. And, you know, when you look at the races that are outstanding, it's a number of races in California that haven't been called yet. But if you look at those, most of those races, our candidate is leading the way right now. You know, we're watching them all closely. We still have a few opportunities to flip seats. You know, the state of Alaska is still out, although we're ahead right now. And so we have a real opportunity to flip that seat from Democrat to Republican. Another similar seat in California where we're leading in a seat that is currently held by a Democrat. So we could even grow the majority, but I feel very confident we'll hold the majority. And that's the most important thing. The Senate went Republican. They picked up another, as you pointed out, in Pennsylvania. And then President Trump not only ran the table, got the popular vote, but in historic fashion, won every single swing state, all seven. And I was in every swing state. In fact, I traveled with President Trump on Sunday. I was in every swing district all over the country helping our candidates over these last few weeks. Everybody was leaving it all out on the field. But I saw the energy, Tony. People were fed up with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden's policies. They want to secure the border. They want to get gas prices and food prices lower. But they were incredibly turned off by things like the weaponization of government, the constant just berating of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, calling people garbage, calling people Nazis and Hitler and racists. It's not working, Tony. People are tired of that kind of disgusting rhetoric, and I think it backfired on them because they offered no agenda. We were talking about the pocketbook issues that families are struggling with and how we're going to fix them and get this country back on track.
Well, the only issue that I heard Vice President Kamala Harris talk about over and over and over again was abortion
yeah.
Until birth. And of course, you yeah. handled
paid for by taxpayers.
Yeah, right. And beyond. I mean, they just obviously the American people rejected that agenda. So let's talk yeah. about that agenda going forward as once you secure the majority. By the way, what do you think your margins will be? I mean, are we going to be 221, 222? What do you think?
Yeah, it's going to be right around there. And look, we started with about that majority. We have a 4-seat majority today. You know, we could end up right around the same spot. Everybody knew just the way redistricting has happened over the last few years, you don't have the ability to get to the days of a 30-seat majority on right. either side. So whoever won, it was going to be a close majority. So we're right about where we thought we would be. You know, there were definitely a couple that we lost that we wanted to get. A lot of spending, you know, in a lot of these races, $30 million or more was spent against our candidates. You know, we're looking into some of the questionable spending activities, but at the same time, you know, our candidates had messages, and that's why we're pulling out a lot of very close wins in some really tough Joe Biden districts. You know, those are the ones that, you know, that really worked well for us. Having President Trump at the top of the ticket helped us in a state like Pennsylvania, where we flipped 2 seats from Democrat to Republican. And then a candidate, an incumbent like Scott Perry, who was in a really tough race, they dumped millions, Tony, against him in the last couple of weeks. And people thought they were writing him off. They thought he was right. going to lose. And in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Scott pulled it out. We went and campaigned for him in the last week. And again, you saw the energy on the ground, and people were very pro-Trump and very pro-Scott Perry, and he was able to pull it out in a very close race, which means, you know, all of that work paid off.
And I think to the point that you made, people need to understand those days of these huge majorities, margins in the House are gone because of the redistricting, how narrowly divided the country is. So that means that you've got to be very, very precise with your agenda because you only have a few votes to work with that you can lose when you're pushing things through the House. So let's talk about that 100-day agenda. What are those issues that are going to be addressed when the new Congress hits the ground?
Yeah, look, we've got a very unique opportunity with unified government. Doesn't happen often. Republicans have the White House, House, and Senate. And we're going to make the most of it by going and fighting for those families who are struggling. You know, we ran on a very strong agenda of getting our economy back on track, Tony, of securing America's border, standing up for our allies around the world, getting rid of these crazy regulations, promoting more American energy. We're going to be focused on doing those things in the first 100 days. You know, and you think about literally starting in January, the first 100 days, delivering on some really big things and getting the economy moving again, lowering costs at the grocery store, at the gas pump. I think you're going to see this economy turn around quickly. Geez, look, the day after the election, the stock market took off like something we hadn't seen since
right.
2022
right.
because people are optimistic and excited again because the Marxists, the communists were defeated. I mean, this direction they were trying to take our country, Tony, we couldn't sustain the spending, the radical policies, the open border, all the things they were doing. And now we're going to finally have an opportunity to turn around. We're not going to blow this opportunity. We are focused on what that first 100 days will look like, and I think it's going to excite people around the country.
Steve, you mentioned that the financial issues, the tax policies that benefit middle-income families, those, some of those are expiring,
yeah.
So the timing is just right. Are those going to be a part of that package?
Tony, that's going to be front and center. One of the first things we do is make sure we don't have a tax increase. And President Trump was very clear about this. And we are in sync with President Trump on this. Look, I spoke with President Trump months ago about what that first 100 days could look like to make sure when we start in January, we will all be on the same page. We don't have the luxury of spending a few months trying to figure it out. We are going to start bullish on day one with a bold conservative agenda. You know, keep tax rates low. President Trump talked on the campaign trail about a number of things like no taxes on tips and, you know, taxes on overtime, other things. You know, we're going to be looking at all of those things. You know, we're going to have a lot of negotiations with our members with a small majority. You know, Democrats unfortunately walked away in 2017 from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Not a single Democrat voted to cut taxes. Of course, it turned our economy around. It was great for the American people. But the Democrat Party just doesn't believe in giving you more of your money back. We do as Republicans, and we will, even if we have to go it on our own. But it's going to be good for the economy. And so we're going to be working with a small majority, but we're still going to be a focused majority working with President Trump to deliver some big wins for those hardworking families who are struggling.
Congressman Steve Scalise, let's talk about the weaponization. I mean, a lot of Americans for the first time in the last 4 years have lived in fear of their own government. Is that on the agenda?
It is. And in fact, you know, this came up in a lot of places. I mean, look, I went to every swing state, Tony. You know, you would have people coming up going, you know, people watch what they were doing to President Trump and his family. I mean, they tried to ruin the guy. They tried to put him in jail. They tried to kill him. I mean, no person in political history has been more persecuted personally than Donald Trump. And he still gets up and fights for the American people. But this weaponization has to end. You know, it's really rich right now. When you watch the media today, just watch the media. They're going, oh, gee whiz, is Donald Trump going to retaliate against all those people who went after him? And these agencies are all scared to death. I'm like, why didn't they think about that when they were going after Donald Trump? Why didn't they just say, we're going to stop today? They should just say, we're done. We're not going to go after Donald Trump anymore. And believe me, Donald Trump's going to clean house. He's going to get rid of all the dirty cops. And it needs to happen because I think people really want, Tony, and this came up a lot of places, they want a restored faith, and they deserve a restored faith in these agencies that we used to trust. And you know, with law enforcement type agencies at the federal level that used to stand for law and order that started now just focusing on their political enemies, not about keeping Americans safe. That has to change. And I think that's going to be front and center in the things President Trump does when he appoints an attorney general and other people in those positions. It's going to be critical who he picks, because he's going to need to bring in tough people who want a clean house. And believe me, we all know President Trump's tough.
Right. 45 seconds left. Last question, Congressman Steve Scalise. Do we need to be worried about the lame duck session of Congress?
No, look, there's a lot of work still left to be done. You know, and I do think we need to get final agreements on government funding. We shouldn't be dumping that work onto President Trump. When he comes in, we need to have all of these issues resolved. The National Defense Authorization Act, the Farm Bill. There's a lot of work we have left that wasn't done this year that needs to get finished. We should not push that off into next year and kind of clog up the first few months of President Trump's administration, cleaning up last year's mess. President Trump's got a bold agenda. He wants to go to work fixing the problems that Joe Biden and Kamala created. We need to take care of our business before the end of this year so he can have that fresh start.
So no tricks from Chuck Schumer over in the Senate we got to be worried
and
about?
No Christmas Eve omnibuses and all that garbage. You know, Speaker Johnson made it clear last year, we're done with that. We put that to bed last year. We're not going to do that again this year.
All right. Very good. Congressman Steve Scalise, always great to see you, my friend. Thanks for joining us today.
Great being with you. God bless, Tony. God bless America, too.
The Republican leader in the House, Steve Scalise. All right. Coming up, we'll share how voters in Nebraska stood up for life and how their leadership led. That's next. Don't go away.
Not be discouraged. Don't lose heart. Don't lose the faith. Stand now strong because the Lord has given us the great privilege of living in a time when our choices matter, when our lives matter, when our courage matters. So let's stand together and save this great country. God bless the United States of America.
The American Republic has a freedom like no other. It has roots in the scriptures far more than any other heritage. And if we as followers of Jesus and conservatives don't defend it, who will?
Neutrality is not an option. There are many Christians who believe that if we just keep our heads down, if we just don't say the wrong thing, that somehow we will come out of this unscathed. You're naive if you think that. because what they want from us is not our silence. What they want from us is our submission.
Part of the dilemma of Christianity in our generation is that we've relied a little too much on human wisdom and human reasoning, human strength, human resource, and we've relied too little on the power of God and God's ability to open doors that we can't open and do things that we couldn't even hope to begin to do.
This may not be an easy task, but we are living in a moment of challenge, but also of great opportunity. And we know always that we are not alone, that His Spirit empowers us and protects us, and that He can do the unimaginable. Dobbs, after all, was never supposed to happen.
Father, we thank You. You have entrusted us with this moment in history, and I pray that we would be found faithful, and that as a result of our faithfulness to You, that thousands, millions would come into the kingdom as they would experience the forgiveness of sin and the new life that is found only in Jesus Christ. Amen.
Download the new Stand Firm app for Apple and Android phones today and join a wonderful community of fellow believers. We've created a special place for you to access news from a biblical perspective, read and listen to daily devotionals, pray for current events, and more. Share the Stand Firm app with your friends, family, and church members, and stand firm everywhere you go.
Are you a Christian parent looking to raise a spiritual champion in today's culture? Renowned author George Barna has written a new book, Raising Spiritual Champions. This book offers valuable insights based on extensive research conducted by George Barna, the Family Research Council, and Arizona Christian University. Learn how to help your children discern biblical truth and find compelling meaning and purpose. Don't miss out on this essential resource for parents. Order your copy today.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us on this Thursday. Let me encourage you to get the Stand Firm app so you can have all kinds of information right at your fingertips. You can get it at the App Store, Stand Firm, or text APP, APP to 67742. All right, for the past month or so now, we've been talking about the 10 states where Planned Parenthood and their allies were working to enshrine a so-called right to abortion in state constitutions. Well, sadly, they succeeded in 7 of those 10 states on Tuesday. And by the way, all 7 were blue states. It wasn't a surprise, though still disappointing. But they failed in 3 red states. They failed in Florida, South Dakota, and Nebraska. Furthermore, in Nebraska, voters approved a pro-life measure that was on the ballot. The only state where they had a kind of a competing to be for something, for life. And that made it even more clear that Nebraskans stand for life. But as we talked about yesterday, in each of these 3 states where it succeeded, they had leaders that stepped forward, knew how to talk about the issue. And life is a winning issue when you know how to talk about it and you're not ashamed of it and you embrace it. Joining now to discuss this, Nebraska Attorney General Mike Hilgers. General Hilgers, thanks so much for joining us here on Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me today, Tony.
First off, tell us about the significance of these ballot measures that were on the ballot there in Nebraska.
Well, certainly it was significant because of what you just said, that we, post-Dobbs, we have been under attack. And there were 7 states prior to Tuesday where a pro-abortion initiative petitions had been put on the ballot, and we were 0-7. And so this was an opportunity for Nebraska, a state that has been a pro-life leader for years. Think about our leadership on the 20-week ban, or think about our state's leadership on partial birth abortion, to say, no, it's not gonna happen here. And as you mentioned, Tony, we did have the dueling petitions, and not only did the pro-life petition pass, but the pro-abortion, a petition that would have enshrined a right to an abortion, a very broadly written right to an abortion in the Nebraska state's constitution, did not pass. And that is a significant, I think, turning of the tide in our country.
So it is. And I'm glad you pointed out that what we've seen since Dobbs, as we've seen states like Ohio, a pro-life state, we saw Kentucky, we've seen other states, Kansas. So what lessons did you learn? And I say you, the pro-life community there in Nebraska, that made a difference that helped your state succeed?
Well, some of it is strategic, and we had amazing leadership. I have to give an enormous amount of credit to our statewide leaders, Senator Ricketts, both financially and as an advocate for the pro-life 434, our pro-life petition, our governor, Governor Pillen, our state auditor, Mike Foley, people across the state. We had strategic leadership. We were well funded. I think having the alternate petition was also very clarifying. Because one, it gave something for people to vote for, but it also put into stark relief, really, the extremism of the pro-abortion ballot petition. As one just very small example, Tony, 434, the pro-life petition, talked very clearly about the right of babies and of women. And 439, the pro-abortion petition, talked about all persons having a right to abortion, man, women, and child, I suppose. And so I think it really put in stark relief the extremism. Beyond that, we had a very committed and unified group of people who were fighting it. We had great advertisements and really, I think, articulated the message. All those elements were critical and I think give other states a playbook for pushing back against these really extreme pro-abortion petitions.
Well, General, we saw in Florida where you have a governor, Ron DeSantis, who's pro-life. In fact, he went out and he did very similar to what the leadership there in Nebraska did, fought against their pro-abortion amendment. They didn't have a pro-life amendment. They just had the pro-abortion, and they were successful in defeating it there. He also ran for re-election in 2022, having signed, I believe it was a heartbeat bill into law, a very strong pro-life bill, and he won handedly. So I think it's, let me put this in the form of a question. It's being comfortable enough to talk about this to, as you said, use the terms that people understand. They understand mom, they understand baby, they understand woman, and they get it if you just talk about it.
Couldn't be more right, Tony. But think about this. For 50 years, what's been the language of the pro-life movement? Yes, it's been about women and it's been about babies, but it's largely been about an anti-democratic Supreme Court that's taken this decision away from states and from the political arena. And so for 50 years, we were fighting really a different type of battle, which is just give us the chance to fight for babies. We won that battle. And now what we're seeing is we have to have leadership fight on a different battlefront and use different arguments because we're no longer in the battle of the courtroom. We're now in the public arena battling it out. And that requires, just like it did 50 years before, strong leadership, people who have clarity of vision, who have moral certainty and are able to communicate the message of the pro-life movement, which is universal in my view. And when it happens, to your point, Tony, it happened in Florida, it happened in Nebraska. When it happens, we win. And we just need more of that. And hopefully these victories will embolden leaders to do just that.
Well, there's another battlefront, General, that you've been fighting on. And that's when we have an administration like the Biden-Harris administration that are pushing these policies, pro-abortion policies, even post-Dobbs, onto states. And it's the attorney generals like yourselves that have fought back. Talk about some of those battles that you've been fighting against the Biden administration.
Oh, gosh, Tony. We don't have enough time to talk about all of them. And I couldn't be more thankful that we're going to have an administration that's going to respect the boundaries of the Constitution. But for years under the Biden-Harris administration, even before that with the Obama administration, there have been so many efforts to go outside of the constitutional boundaries to try to settle really difficult issues that should be in the halls of Congress or in states through bureaucratic means. Just to give you a couple of, for instances, one recent one was the Biden administration's effort to use Title IX, the authority it has under Title IX, to force schools to allow boys into girls' bathrooms or to allow boys to play in girls' sports, which Nebraskans and Americans know is not authorized by Congress and is totally anti-common sense. That was a coalition of state AGs fought back against that, and we got that and joined. That's just one small example, Tony, of the battles we've had to fight against this unconstitutional administration, and couldn't be more grateful to actually have an administration come in soon in January that will respect the boundaries of the Constitution.
It will be a breath of fresh air, no doubt, for all the red state attorneys generals who have been working 24/7 to keep the Biden-Harris administration in check. General Hilgers, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your leadership. Grateful for it.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for all that you do communicating to the country. It's very needed. Thank you.
All right. This is why we've been talking about local elections. I know everybody focuses on the presidential, and that's great. It's important, very important. But also having attorneys general like this in states across the country, governors, legislators, all important. All right, we're going to meet one of the new members of Congress, a familiar face and voice. Stick around.
Everything we do begins as an idea. Before there can be acts of courage, there must be the belief that some things are worth sacrificing for. Before there can be marriage, there is the idea that man should not be alone. Before there was freedom, there was the idea that individuals are created equal. It's true that all ideas have consequences, but we're less aware that all consequences are the fruit of ideas. Before there was murder, there was hate. Before there was a Holocaust, there was the belief by some people that other people are undesirable. Our beliefs determine our behavior, and our beliefs about life's biggest questions determine our worldview. Where did I come from? Who decides what is right and wrong? What happens when I die? Our answers to these questions explain why people see the world so differently. Debates about abortion are really disagreements about where life gets its value. Debates over sexuality and gender and marriage are really disagreements about whether the rules are made by us or for us. What we think of as political debates are often much more than that. They're disagreements about the purpose of our lives and the source of truth. As Christians, our goal must be to think biblically about everything. Our goal is to help you see beyond red and blue, left and right, to see the battle of ideas at the root of it all. Our goal is to equip Christians with a biblical worldview and help them advance and defend the faith in their families, communities, and the public square. Cultural renewal doesn't begin with campaigns and elections. It begins with individuals turning from lies to truth. But that won't happen if people can't recognize a lie and don't believe truth exists. We want to help you see the spiritual war behind the political war, the truth claims behind the press release, and the forest from the trees.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Do you have the Stand Firm app? Well, if not, you can get it. Go to the App Store, get the Stand Firm app, or text app, APP, to 67742. I've often mentioned how encouraging it has been to see how God has called more and more men and women of faith here to our nation's capital to serve in a job that can be thankless in the eyes of many. Politics, it's dirty. But you know what? Somebody has to do it. And if we want government, and we pray for righteous government, we need to have righteous people in it if that's what we want. And so I'm thankful that God is doing that. And when we have more and more spiritually active, governance-engaged conservatives voting and others stepping up, well, what? You know what? I believe we'll see a positive change in Washington. And it's here. It's happening. So I am pleased to be joined right now by one individual who has been called in. Congressman-elect Mark Harris, a longtime pastor who has been representing, who will be representing the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina come January, but he's been here at the Family Research Council for about a decade working with our pastors and our churches. Dr. Harris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's great to be with you tonight.
Well, congratulations again. I know you were with us on election night in our Pray Vote Stand election decision 2024 coverage. And we talked about how this was your second campaign for Congress. In the first campaign, you saw firsthand the extreme lengths the left will go to capture power. Talk about that for just a moment and what you've learned in that journey.
Well, obviously, if you don't know our story, in 2018, I was elected in the general election to the 116th Congress at that time. And we went through orientation, in fact, and we're coming into that second week of orientation when the State Board of Elections got involved, and it just became a mess. The story's too long to tell. There's a book about it called 13 Ballots, the manufactured scandal that overturned an election, and the foreword was by Governor Mike Huckabee. But the book explains all the details that we went through and the nightmare that it was. Just in, as you said, the links that the left will go to in order to try to steal an election, take an election. But nevertheless, God in his timing and in his wisdom has brought things full circle. And I now have the privilege of being able to represent the 8th District of North Carolina in the U.S. House of Representatives. And very, very thankful.
Now, you're replacing another good friend of ours, and that is Congressman Dan Bishop. So you got, it's a conservative district. It's had good, solid leadership, and I know it's going to continue under your leadership. What are you looking to tackle when you arrive here or when you go to work in January?
Well, you know, I think we're just really looking to fulfill the commitment and the promises that we've made to the people all across my district and really across this country. We're still seeing the results that are trickling in from election night, and it is beginning to look more and more that we are going to be able to hold the House of Representatives. And in fact, with the results of election night, it looks like we're going to have the White House, definitely going to have the U.S. Senate, and with a majority in the House, there are going to be a lot of things that, that we're going to be able to do to really fulfill the commitment that a lot of us have made. It's going to be an opportunity that we all had been hoping for. And right now, folks are just trying to work to make sure that we're going to be able to fulfill those things and make the first 100 days the most effective that they can possibly be. President Trump made it very clear in his campaign, we want to do things with the border immediately. We want to be able to get this economy, begin to create an environment where our economy will boom once again and where the prices that people are paying are not going to be as burdensome as they've been. And we're going to deal with energy. And I mean, the list could go on, but we've got to get the priorities, we've got to get the strategy, and then we've got to be able to move forward effectively together.
Yeah, as House Speaker Mike Johnson said, there's a lot to fix. And that is
that is
true. And let me ask you this. We just got a couple minutes left, Mark. But, you know, at the Family Research Council, when you're here, you worked with first culture impact teams, the community impact teams in churches across the country, and then working with pastors. How critical was that in, as you saw that as a candidate, to have churches that were both informed and engaged?
Oh, I think it was critical. I mean, I was very blessed in our race to win significantly. It is a great district. But one of the things that we did, in fact, just to give a shout out to the communications gentleman right there, the Vice President of Communications, Kenan Curran, FRC, he had a sermon that I just actually took that sermon and shared it with pastors all across the 8th Congressional District of North Carolina. And it urged people to get out and vote. It urged them to pray, vote, and stand. And I think that was significant. I believe that. I believe if we sit on the sidelines, we're going to continue to watch our country in a great decline. But I believe that believers will be salt and light, and that they will step in and they will pray, seeking the very throne of heaven with the issues that we're facing today. And then they're willing to vote, be engaged in the process, and then willing to stand. We're going to be able to get this country back on the right track. And the people I'm already meeting here in this first few days since I've been elected that are coming to Washington are coming with a passion. They're coming with a faith. They're coming with a heart. And you know this, Tony, from the folks you've already engaged here. There is a strong spiritual element in the hearts and minds of many of the men and women that God's bringing together in Congress. And I'm hopeful for the future.
And I think that's why the left is so worked up, because this will go after the real source of the problem. It's spiritual, and you got political leaders that understand the spiritual nature. You put those two together, and it becomes powerful. Congressman-elect Mark Harris, great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's always an honor.
All right, Congressman Mark Harris of North Carolina. All right, don't go away. After the break, I'll be joined by Carolyn Glick from Israel as we talk about how they're celebrating President-elect Trump.
Jesus said in John 15, "These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full." In 2024, in these divided and uncertain times, how can this be possible? By abiding in him through his word. At Family Research Council, We want to help you do that, which is the reason for the Stand on the Word Bible Reading Plan. In just 10 to 15 minutes each day, you will have read the entire Bible in just 2 years. But more importantly, you will be abiding in Him daily. Find our Bible reading plan at frc.org/Bible. And join Tony Perkins each weekday for a 10-minute devotional inspired by the daily reading and designed to encourage you on this journey through the Bible. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And remember, the grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever.
The world is hurting. Streets are filled with crime. Families are broken. Sin is celebrated and God is mocked. Everywhere we look, the wages of our sin are on full display. As Christians, we know that surrender to God's will is the solution to our biggest problems, but not everyone agrees. Even in church, we hear people say the most important thing is to be tolerant, that we shouldn't impose a morality on other people, and that loving our neighbor means celebrating what they do. But you can't do that. It's not that you don't love your neighbor, you do. But you care about God's opinion more than your neighbor's opinion, and this makes you different. In fact, sometimes it makes you feel alone, like you're the only one. But there is good news. You are not alone, not even close. Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these SageCons yourself, go to frc.org/SageCon and take the quiz to find out. The world is hurting, and we have the solution. We can't do it alone, but we can do it if we work together. That's what we're working toward every day. Join us. Go to frc.org/SageCon, SageCon, to learn more. That's SageCon, SageCon, to learn more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us. Our word for today comes from Joel chapter 2. Blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly. Gather the people, consecrate the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, even the nursing infants. Between the porch and the altar, let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep and say, spare your people, O Lord, and make not your heritage a reproach, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? Now, this passage given during a national crisis points to the people repenting. The spiritual condition of a nation must be a priority, led by spiritual leaders. Everyone, from elders to infants, is summoned to set aside personal matters and seek God. The priests were to stand in the temple courtyard, backs to the altar, symbolizing they have nothing left but a plea for mercy as they faced the presence of God, weeping for the people. Well, just as in Joel's time, in this passage, it challenges us today to acknowledge the need for national repentance and for spiritual leaders to lead the way in the nation returning to God. For more on our journey through the Bible, text Bible to 67742. Well, the decisive victory of now President-elect Donald Trump has more wondering what it will mean for the conflicts in Europe and in the Middle East. Well, Iran's president reportedly said, quote, it makes no difference to us who won the U.S. election. But I'm not sure everyone agrees with him, including my next guest. She may be inclined to disagree. Joining me now from Israel to discuss this and other developments in the Middle East is Carolyn Glick. She is a senior contributing editor at the Jewish News Syndicate and host of Carolyn Glick's show on JNS. Carolyn, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your program this week, Tony.
All right, first,
it's a big week.
Yeah, it is a big week, and I want to get the reaction from Israel to Tuesday night's election outcome.
You know, I saw a snap poll that said that 67% of Israelis were very happy with the election outcome in Israel, which sort of tabulates with the polls all along, which had Trump winning 65 to 75% of the support of Israelis in polling of who Israelis wanted to have as the next president of the United States. So, yeah, 2/3 of Israelis were pretty much jubilant at the results. And you can understand why.
Well,
you
know? Unpack that. Why? What do the Israeli, what does the Israeli public see Trump bringing to the table here?
Trump was the most pro-Israel president that Israel ever had. It wasn't just, you know, it was he did the whole thing. You know, it was he recognized that Jerusalem is Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy finally after 30 years of empty promises from presidents. And even though it was required for them to move the embassy to Jerusalem under law since 1996, he recognized Israeli sovereignty in the Golan Heights. He started moving away from the fake two-state solution, which is really, as we saw on October 7th, a means to eradicate the Jewish state by placing an enemy state in our heartland. You know, he just was pro-Israel. He defunded UNRWA. He defunded the Palestinian Authority. He did so much. And he recognized the legality of Israel's communities in Judea and Samaria. So his was an extraordinary record. And then Biden came in and replaced him. And, oh, and of course, he oversaw the conclusion of the Abraham Accords that brought Israel peace with four Arab and Muslim states for the first time in over two decades. So, I mean, I think he just was such an extraordinary transformational leader in terms of American Middle East policy, and he was very successful. He left the Iranian nuclear deal, and he placed crippling sanctions on Iran that dried up their reserves and their ability to finance all of their terror proxies around Israel. And then the Biden administration came in. They tried to kill the Abraham Accords by trying to force everybody to bow down again to the Palestinians in their midst. They reinstated U.S. financing to UNRWA, which worked out to be an in-house terrorist organization. And then once the war started, they started constantly threatening arms embargo. They slowed weapons deliveries. They sanctioned Israeli citizens who oppose the establishment of a Palestinian state and oppose continuing to resupply Hamas under the headline of humanitarian aid. They passed a ceasefire a resolution at the UN Security Council that was totally against Israel's desires and Israel's interests and Israel's military imperatives. They tried to block every strategic action that Israel has taken, wishes to take in Gaza, in Lebanon, and of course in Iran. So they've just been horrible. They've ostracized our leaders. They've threatened to sanction our ministers. So we've never had a more hostile. It's We've like never had a more hostile administration.
Polar opposite. Is there some expectation that with the United States not getting in the way, but actually maybe assisting, that we can see the IDF, the Israeli administration, move forward and finish off the hostilities that are taking place between Hamas and Hezbollah?
I think there's every reason to believe that the war can end quickly. The problem is the reason that it's been so prolonged is that the United States kept subverting Israel's war effort. And, you know, the fact that we're still in this fight, despite all the efforts by the Biden administration to try to force Israel to capitulate without defeating Hamas, without dismantling Hezbollah forces that were perched along the border with northern Israel, is a testament to the strength of the leadership of Prime Minister Netanyahu, that he was able to withstand unbelievable pressure from the administration to stand down, to accept a deal that would leave Israel in strategic peril of further invasion from the north, from the east, and constant missile attacks. We've been attacked. Iran has conducted two massive ballistic missile assaults on Israel in the past several months, and they're promising more. And the administration's response was to protect Iran's nuclear installations from Israel by threatening Israel again with an arms embargo and UN Security Council condemnations if Israel attacks Iran's nuclear sites. So, I mean, you know, it's really just been one long slog with the Biden administration, and Harris promised to be even worse than Biden from Israel's perspective. So that explains, I think, the jubilation.
It's a little interesting. I saw a press report today that a senior Hamas official has called for an immediate end to the war with Israel. It would appear that they're hoping to get the Biden administration to lean in and negotiate a better deal for them to end the war before the Trump administration comes in.
Well, I mean, we'll have to see what they're talking about. Obviously, if it would involve securing Israel's military objectives, including releasing all of the hostages, 101 Israelis are still being held in Hamas's tunnels. Certainly over 50 of them are still considered to be alive. So, I mean, we're talking about a heinous situation, and we'll just have to see if they're willing to give us back all of the hostages and accept military terms that enable Israel to protect itself, then that would be fine. But it really does sort of remind you of Iran releasing the U.S. hostages that were being held in Tehran for 444 days after the takeover of the U.S. embassy, and they released them after Reagan was elected president, I think the day that he was inaugurated, so or something like that. So it's the same. It's along the same lines.
It wouldn't be surprising. You know, Trump has the same approach. Peace through strength. He made those comments in his acceptance speech early Wednesday morning. You mentioned Iran. The Iranian president said, "It doesn't really matter who's president. You know, we're going to continue on." Do you agree? Do you think that this changes the landscape in terms of the Middle East and Iranian activity?
Yeah, I think that American credibility is back. You know, the Biden administration, like the Obama administration before it, kept saying, we're not going to let Iran get nuclear weapons, while they enabled it. You know, they said we were imposing sanctions on Iran when they stopped enforcing them. And Trump imposed very, very harsh economic sanctions on Iran that brought the regime to its knees. And certainly dried up much of the wells of financing that Iran had available to pay for Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis and all their other terror proxy armies. So the obvious difference is it almost needs no explanation. And the Iranians certainly understand the distinction between Trump's policies and Obama and Biden's, which is why they've been trying to assassinate him.
Now, you've written a piece on how Trump's victory paves the way for a strategic realignment in the Middle East. You also included the firing of Israeli defense minister as also playing a part in that path. Tell us about that.
You know, Israel has, unfortunately, a situation where many of our top security brass are really aligned with the Democratic Party in the United States. And the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and many of our retired generals, and apparently some of the sitting generals and the general staff, were working with the Pentagon under the Biden administration and scuttling the government's decisions to take actions that would have significantly changed the strategic environment on the ground in Gaza, as well as in Lebanon and Iran. So, for instance, if you remember, for months and months, you and I were talking about it, was all over the news that Israel kept saying we have to go into Rafah, which is the border community between Gaza and Egypt, and seize control over the international border. And Harris and Biden and Blinken and Austin were all threatening Israel with sanctions and embargoes if we dare to go into Rafah. They kept saying that it was going to be a bloodbath, that there were over a million people there, and that they were all going to die, and it was all going to be Israel's fault if we went in. And their efforts were joined by Gallant, who is the defense minister, and Herzliya Levy, the chief of staff of the IDF, and they kept trying to block the operation in Rafah. And it went on and on for months, and there were other, things going in and out. But basically, you saw this move that was common, that was being done together by the administration and by Gallant and the chief of staff of the Army to undermine the government's plans and decisions. And the thing about Rafah that was so important was that it's a strategic objective, because if you seize Rafah, you seize the international border, then you cut Hamas off from its international supply lines, whether it's cash, personnel, war material, and we saw dozens of tunnels that traverse the border between Gaza and Egypt. Some of them were wide enough to drive a tank through. So, you know, you're talking about a major smuggling operation that continued to go on until Israel finally got into Rafah and took it over. And the American effort to block that operation was an effort to maintain Hamas's grip on power and its survival. So you had these generals, including General Gallant, who's the defense minister until today or until tomorrow morning officially. And they were working hand in glove with the Americans and trying to block it. And there are a lot of different reasons for it. But the bottom line is that so long as he remained defense minister, he was a political obstacle to the government, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, moving forward and achieving Israel's strategic objectives in the war in Gaza, which is to destroy Hamas as a military organization and as a political entity, and to maintain that destruction over time so that they can't pose a threat to Israel in the future. In Lebanon, it's to dismantle Hezbollah forces along the border with Israel to allow Israeli citizens, 80,000 of whom have been internal refugees since October 8th of last year, to go home safely, and also to vastly diminish Hezbollah's missile arsenal that we've seen. They had a direct hit at Ben Gurion International Airport yesterday. They can at their whim paralyze half the country or more with these missiles, and so Israel has to destroy them as well. And finally, with Iran, it's to block Iran's move towards nuclear weapons. And, in all of these things, the administration was trying to block Israel from achieving its strategic objectives. And unfortunately, we had these generals, including Gallant, who were assisting them. So now you have the Trump administration coming into office in 2.5 months. And their arrival on the scene is like a knight in shining armor saying, look, we don't oppose Israel winning anymore. In fact, we support Israel's pursuit of victory in this war. And in order to achieve that victory, though, you need the team in Israel that's going to want to pursue that victory. And you can't have generals that are aligned with the Democrat Party running the show, because right, they're not going to deliver what we need.
Very interesting. Carolyn, we just have about a minute and a half left. You mentioned 2.5 months before the Trump administration comes in. I know there's jubilation, celebration now. Is there concern about what could happen during that 2.5 months?
And there is grave concern because, the Obama administration, in its last months in office, they passed a deeply hostile resolution against Israel at the UN Security Council. It's called 2234, and it declares all Israeli presence beyond the 1949 armistice lines, including in Jerusalem, including the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, an illegal presence, an illegal settlement, and calls essentially for the international community to boycott Israel in those areas. And there was supposed to be a follow-on resolution afterwards that was going to put a timetable on Israeli withdrawals from Judea and Samaria and the establishment of a Palestinian state, and then place sanctions on Israel if Israel didn't abide by that dictated timeline from the Security Council. And Israel, working with the transition team for the Trump administration that was coming in 8 years ago, was able to block that second resolution, which would have been disaster strategically from passing. So that's a sort of thing that we can look to in terms of cooperation with the incoming right Trump transition team today as well.
And I actually had a conversation with the speaker this morning, and I think with the mandate that the president feels that he has, that we're likely to see less of that happen this time, but vigilance is required. Carolyn Glick, always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Absolutely. And folks, we're going to be launching a prayer initiative to cover these 2.5 months, because things like Israel, even domestically, we need to be praying. And so stay tuned for more details on that. It'll be coming in the next day or two. So we're going to need you to pray. All right, out of time for today. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, I leave you once again with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. Just keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.